I'm going to read two sections today. I'm going to start with the prologue, not surprisingly, of this book. And then I'm going to read from chapter 3, which introduces the character of Belezian Drolnar, who is a kind of a political strongman. You'll hear the description of him a little bit more in that chapter. And it will also introduce you to a race of creatures called the Arlok. And I'll, you know, we can talk a little bit about that afterwards if you're interested. So, Torek Ilmon, the most recent member of a farmer's bloodline stretching back centuries, perhaps even before the dreamer's first dream, wiped beads of sweat from his brow before bending again to drive his hoe into the earth. It was late summer, and already hints of the oncoming fall were in the air, but hot work was hot, regardless of the season. The harvest had been particularly good this year, as good as any that even Torek's grandfather could remember, but that did little to alleviate his workload. Reaping the fruitfulness of the earth had left many wounds, and the soil had to be worked, turned, and coaxed back to its natural aerated condition if it was to yield similar results next spring. This was tiring, tedious work for most, but for Torek it represented a kind of spiritual ritual, a bonding with the land he needed to experience each year to feel he was fulfilling the promise of his heritage. Land was meant to be tilled, dug, shoveled, filtered. It was meant to be used and cared for so that it could be used again, and Torek felt the weight of that responsibility keenly. All the Ilmons did. He was perhaps not the most creative thinker or possessed of the most ambitious, quick mind, but he was committed to his work and difficult to sway from a path he had set for himself. Pulling back on the hoe handle again, Torek stood the implement in the earth as he straightened, sighing with the effort. He looked over his field, almost all resurfaced now from his work with the hoe, and beyond it to the borders of the wood that lay to the east of the Ilmon farm. Tragsclaw Wood was the official name of the forest, but despite the rumors, it seldom produced anything more dramatic than a wandering bear. Unnatural creatures were few, unexpected events even fewer. Torek liked it that way, as did his neighbors. Their lives were founded upon regular, predictable cycles, and their existence depended upon careful planning and the application of age-old wisdom. Successions, disasters, and wars certainly happened beyond the borders of his homeland, informally known as the Fields by its residents, but such occurrences made little impact upon its inhabitants. They were content to live as they had for centuries, and it had indeed been centuries since anyone had bothered to interfere with that simple life. Torek grunted with satisfaction as he leaned on his hoe, looking around the borders of his land. Far to the south lay the hills which ran between Tragsclaw Wood to the east and the southernmost area of Razorwood to the west, and even farther to the north were the major cities of the nation of Klum. But Torek, as ever, was most interested in his own space. In his grandfather's time, the field had barely extended to 10 acres, but now it was nearly double that, one of the largest farms in the area and expanding every year. He employed a group of laborers to help him with the upkeep, of course, but they had already been sent home. Torek wanted time to work the land alone, and the unusually good harvest had given him the luxury to indulge himself. This was the time he loved, a few hours of silent thought and careful tending of his ancestral ground. Torek smiled and shook himself out of his late afternoon reverie. He didn't want to waste the remaining light. Bending again to his work, he drove his hoe into the earth. And then, quite suddenly, the air changed. A stillness fell across the land. The wind sank to a sigh, and the atmosphere seemed to close around Torek, who looked up with a frown. The weathermaster in the next village had told him there was not likely to be rain for at least another week, but they were notoriously inaccurate in their predictions. And even when they were right, and the one Torek had consulted was known for his precision, other weathermasters could generate rain at inopportune times when paid enough by jealous rival farmers. Still, such an occurrence had not happened for several years, and he could think of no reason for a weather call to be made now. He sniffed the air and caught a faint, acrid scent, unusual for any normal storm. After a moment, he returned to his work, hoping to at least finish the field he was working on before the rain arrived. But only a few seconds passed before a low moan echoed across the land. Torek looked up sharply. The sound was fairly loud, without any prior warning to have heralded it, and seemed relatively close by. Perhaps a bear had stepped on the wrong end of a stick, Torek reasoned. But just as he was about to accept the logical answer and focus his attention back on the earth, the moaning came again, more loudly this time and closer. It seemed to come from Tragsclaw Wood, and Torek squinted in that direction. He saw nothing but the fences at the end of his land and the trees beyond. But the stillness seemed to grow more oppressive with every passing minute, and there were no clouds visible in the afternoon sky. The moaning sounded again, louder and with a different timbre, Torah thought he heard some kind of a yowling or screeching, like a cat whose late-night caterwauls were silenced by a thrown rock or rival feline. Inadvertently, he shivered. This was no storm, and there was no animal he knew that made such an unearthly sound. Dropping his hoe, he ran to his nearby cart and pulled out his scythe. It was hardly a weapon of war, but its blade was sharp, and he had killed a wolf with it one winter several years ago. But that wolf had been young, and Torek had not been alone then. He had no idea what he was facing this time. In truth, he had little wish to investigate the noise himself. But he was alone and had no time to run for others. And despite all his imaginings, the sound likely had a simple explanation, as sounds always did. Why give his neighbors the idea that he was imagining things? Gripping the scythe firmly, he ran towards the forest. Torek was no coward, but as he approached the edge of Tragsclaw, his steps slowed. Tragsclaw was not the darkest of woods, nor the densest, but today it felt different, ominous, imposing, heavy. With every step he took, the air seemed to grow closer and more difficult to breathe. After a while, he felt as if he were slogging through mud, so syrupy had the atmosphere become. Pausing at the forest's edge, the scythe's handle damp from his sweat, he peered cautiously into the greenery. He saw nothing but the trees standing silent guard on the forest border, scrubs and moss at their feet. But beyond its unnatural stillness, something struck him as wrong about the forest, though he could not put his finger on what it was. His nose and throat stung with the acrid tang of the air. He was so focused upon the unnatural atmosphere that he had entirely forgotten about what had drawn him to the forest in the first place, the sound. Suddenly the moan echoed again, but this time it seemed to be nearly on top of him and far louder, and now he clearly heard that it was more than a moan. It sounded like several creatures screaming or yelping at once, but, and this he could not understand, they seemed to be both opposed and combined in some way, like some kind of bizarre chorus of discontent. He froze and looked around slowly. Nothing stirred. And he suddenly realized what had eluded his notice before. He saw no living movement at all. No birds flew, no squirrel stirred, no fox darted from tree to tree. He bent down to the ground and dug experimentally. No insects could be seen in the earth, neither worm nor beetle. The land around him seemed utterly, entirely devoid of life. Torek shook his head and turned away from the woods. Strange as it might seem to his neighbors, something was clearly wrong, and he would rather be labeled a coward than a fool. He headed back to his cart, but he felt as if he were walking through sand. It was now very difficult to breathe fully, and the air felt as if it were trying to crush his body into the earth. His mind swam, and his eyes darted from side to side. He had the odd feeling he was waiting for something. All at once, a great moaning and screeching arose, seemingly all around him, the most terrible noise Torek had ever heard. Screaming and howling came from the forest, but not as isolated noises. Rather, they made up a noise together, one sound of painful torment. As Torek dropped to his knees in terror, he heard for several seconds what he swore were voices, human voices shrieking in the most wrenching agony he could have imagined. He struggled to rise, but all energy and strength had deserted him, and his brain seemed unable to command his legs to move again. His breath came in labored gasps. As he turned his head to look back at the woods, he caught a glimpse of swirling colors and odd shapes. And then, with one more deafening scream of agony, it burst out of the forest and was upon him. The soul wall ravaged north, and there had never been any sound more horrible than that of its passing, now joined by one more unreasoning, hideously distorted shout of agony, as if ripped from the lungs of a still living man. Chapter 3. Drawing his black cloak close against the biting rain, Blesi and Drolnar hurried down the nearly deserted city street, and, not for the first time, cursed his bad fortune. It had been bad enough when Duke Galarian had imposed a curfew on an all-too-willing populace, nervous from the increasingly dire news arriving from outside Clun Ilar, cutting down city traffic and distractions for the night watch as he did so. Now this latest patch of bad weather made it almost inconceivable that anyone would have a good reason to be out this late. But Drolnar did have a good reason, just not one he could share with the typical city guardsmen. Far too many questions would result, and he had no time for any of them. The wind whipped the bottom of the cloak around his ankles painfully as he walked, and Drolnar stifled the urge to rip the damned thing off. Without it, he would be soaked to the skin, or at least more soaked than he was at the moment, and would stand out even more than he feared he already did. He knew his way around the streets of Clunillar as well as anyone, and was used to changing routes as necessity demanded. But he was no rogue or assassin, and the merchant garb beneath his cloak was as noticeable as a campfire in the wilderness on a clear evening. As he reached the corner of the main market street, the familiar clank of metal sent him scurrying into a small alcove, his cloak drawn tightly around him. A moment later, two guardsmen appeared, armed with halberds and short swords that hung at their belts, one carrying a hooded lantern that swung back and forth in the wind. As they rounded the corner, the other stopped and put a hand on his companion's shoulder, wiping his face with his other hand. "Why they don't want to issue full gears beyond me," remarked the guard who first stopped. Wet whiskers plastered on his face made him look vaguely like a waterlogged rat. "Without visors, we can barely see 10 feet in front of us, and I don't know how they expect people to fight when they're drenched." "I've heard the treasury's running low, and they don't have much left to get gear out to those who need it," said his somewhat shorter and clean-shaven companion. "Most of the full gear's out to the Arlecs at the border, from what I hear. And the pay, too, I reckon. We'll be the last to get restocked, mark me." The other man snorted. "If they're saving their corn for the Arlecs, they're wasting their money," he said, removing one cloth glove and trying vainly to shake some of the moisture out of it. "From what I've heard, they aren't likely to stay at their post much longer, no matter how much gold you throw at them, and there's no way of knowing when they'll decide to give up the whole business and leave." "You better hope you're wrong, Revith," the other said, "or you'll have a lot more than being wet to worry about. What do you think will happen if they do leave? You've heard the rumors, same as I have, and you know the other side been building up forces a lot more powerful than the captain's willing to tell us. Who's going to stop them if the Arlecs let them through?" "Heh," Revith spat, who, having wrung out one glove, was now squeezing the other. "Whoever will stop them later can't be worse than what we've got now. It's not like the border's been impossible to get over, at least the past 5 years. More than one's gotten through already, and a few of them, I hear," he said as he looked at the other man meaningfully, "might be given the orders up top even now." "Shut your mouth," the other whispered urgently, looking around him nervously. "That's traitor talk, and you know it. Besides, you don't have proof. The captain's been at his post the past 10 years. He sounds the same now as he ever did." "Sounds the same, aye," Revis said undeterred. "But that don't mean he is the same. You remember that Marlowe, 3rd Regiment? A friend of mine said he sounded like the same old Marlowe, till one day he murdered half his company in their sleep. And they never found him, neither. He just sort of vanished, my friend said. Who knows where he got to, or who or what he really was? And even if the captain is just the same, he's got someone he answers to himself. And whoever that is could be given the orders he wants, if you follow me." "Pah, you're being a fool," the other man scoffed. "The city's got its own people to look after that sort of thing, and it's done it for a long time. So Marlowe lost his grip one night. That don't mean he was one of them. And even if you're right, you want more of them coming through? I don't much see you standing up to a bunch of shapeshifters or worse any more than I see you getting promoted to captain anytime soon. The Arlecs now, they've been willing to do it, and they've beat him before, too." "I might be a fool, Solidna," Revith retorted, pulling his glove back on with a frown, "but at least I see what's around me. If the Arlecs leave the border, and they will leave it, mark me, you'd best be ready to stand and fight if need be, because the enemy will hit Clunillar first. If this city falls, you'll need a lot more than Arlecs to stop the storm that blows up next. And if we do have to fight, I'd rather it be with full gear than with this peasant wear." He punctuated this last remark with a hearty shake, like a wet dog trying to dry its fur. "Have it your way, Revith," Solidna replied. "But as for me, I'm a guardsman, not a border soldier. And I'd rather the Arlecs worry about the border than us. In the meantime, we've still got streets to patrol and a report to make, and we're late as is. If there is to be pay, I'd like to be around to get it." "Aye, all right," Revith said reluctantly. "Not much chance of getting dry, anyway." The pair moved off down the street, still talking, and turned another corner at its end. Stoller allowed himself a wry smile as he left the alcove and continued the opposite direction. Guardsmen weren't known for their intelligence, but these oafs were a lot closer to the truth than they knew. But only part of the truth. In the end, they had more to worry about than a few shapeshifters and others from the enemy getting through the border. Hey, sweetie. Finding out how much more, in fact, was his purpose this evening. Cameo appearance by my daughter, for those who don't know. Drolar quickened his pace as he heard the bell from the town center ring 10 times. He had no wish to be late for his appointment. Those he worked with were not particularly forgiving of lateness or anything else from what he could tell, and their meeting was scheduled for 10 minutes past the hour. 2 more streets passed before Drolnar turned right onto a narrow lane. Counting the buildings as he went, he soon began to pass a series of ugly, squat homes. He wrinkled his nose in disgust from the stench, like a combination of rat droppings and blood, he thought with a shudder, and hurried on. He had no idea why the meeting had to take place in this part of the city, an area he came to as little as possible. But he was not in a position to ask questions. Yet. he reminded himself grimly. After another minute, he stopped in front of an unremarkable wooden door on his left and peered down the street in both directions. Other than a rat scurrying behind a barrel, the lane appeared deserted. Satisfied, he leaned over and whispered into the keyhole. A few moments passed, during which time Drolnar wondered a bit nervously if he had miscounted the houses before the door opened a crack. Dim light steamed out from within. "His coming is known to us," a harsh and guttural voice growled from inside. "Our knowledge is our strength," Drolnar replied promptly. Another moment passed before the door opened wider. "Enter and be quick," said the voice, and Drolnar wasted no time. He was relieved to be out of the rain, and the warmth was welcome, but otherwise this was hardly the most comfortable of meeting rooms. Three hard wooden chairs waited near the fireplace, all unoccupied, and a cheerless fire flickered in the hearth behind them. Another door was on the far wall, and one closed and shuttered window was set in the wall next to the front entrance. A small wooden table sat against the opposite end of the room, upon which a rusty lantern and three rough wooden mugs rested. Drolnar started as the door closed behind him with a rather loud bang. "You're late," the voice said as a lock clicked, and he turned to see who was speaking. Drolnar regretted his decision to look almost as soon as he had done so, for the voice was mild compared to the appearance of its owner. He was of medium height and wore a rough woolen cloak, unhooded, with a scarred and burned leather tunic that had clearly been through more than one conflict. A short sword and a pitted leather sheath hung at his side. But far more noticeable was the face, scarred, burned, blue-black in color, with one eye socket entirely closed, and not well, by what looked like a simple flap of skin. The other eye, brown and cold, glared at Drolnar with malice and cunning. A huge scar ran from the edge of his mouth to the dirty brown hair that fell about the man's skull like weeds. Alvinar Drolnar thought he was looking at quite possibly the most ugly and disturbing face he had ever encountered, and Drolnar's profession ensured he had seen thousands of examples of ugliness in his time. But his profession had also trained him in the art of deception on the highest scale, and he had long ago learned not to betray his feelings openly. So he buried his disgust and looked at him calmly. "I came as quickly as I could," he said, "but this isn't the easiest part of the city to find or get to. And I had some work to do to avoid the patrols as well. This would all have been easier if we could have met at the place I suggested first." The other man spat as he walked to the table. "Aye, in the middle of the merchant district, where there's more guards than merchants," he said, taking one of the mugs. "And where you could lay an ambush for me and my lads with your mercenary scum if you wanted more money out of the deal. No, we want no part of your places, cell thief." He chuckled before taking a long drink of whatever the mug held. Drolnar's mouth tightened, and he inadvertently gripped his fist underneath his cloak, as much for the term cell thief as for how close the other man had come to the truth of Drolnar's thoughts. But he quickly regained control and smiled grimly. "You're much too suspicious, friend," he replied. "In the merchant district, my guards are paid by me, not the city. And they get paid enough to keep their mouths shut about whatever they happen to see, or they get their mouths shut for them, permanently. You hardly think," he continued pleasantly, but with the subtlest edge of iron underneath, "that you and your people are the first ones I've dealt with from outside the city. I know more about foreigners than you do, I'll wager, and I understand how to deal with them. If you follow me," he finished with the quiet of a blade being loosened from its sheath. The other man lowered his mug and looked at Drolnar through his one good eye. "And I know how to deal with a fat cutpurse who gets above himself, self-thief." He moved his hand down to the hilt of his short sword almost casually. "We're not friends and won't be. I don't have to buy mine." As Drolnar looked back at the other man's scarred face, he smiled and shrugged off the insult, though inwardly he added the man to his list of those he would deal with when he had the chance. "It's your own choice. I meant no offense. But we have business to conduct, and the hour is late. I have much to do. We should get started. And I don't deal with shadows," he added as the other man moved his hand away from his sword hilt. "I need a name to you, since you already know mine." "It's not hard to know your name with you shouting it at anyone you think will remember it, Belezian Drolnar," the other man sneered. "And I'm the one calling the shots here, not you. But since you'll hear it anyway soon enough, most people call me Rix. That's good enough for you." He leaned against the wall near the table and took another long drink. "As for getting started, that'll happen when we're all here, and not before." "As you wish," Drolnar replied smoothly, though inwardly his stomach tightened a bit. He had known he would be dealing with more than one person, but he had hoped for a single contact within the city. More people meant more variables, and he hated the variables he couldn't influence. Drolnar had built his success on knowledge. Who sold what? Who controlled what trade routes? Who could be bought, sold, and eliminated? The city should have moved against his circle of contacts years ago, and would have, if Drolnar were not aware of nearly every tryst, double deal, and sordid activity of the city's officials. The Duke himself had more than one skeleton in his closet, although Drolnar had to be careful not to overuse that knowledge. Ilarion was concerned about his public image, but more concerned with his own power, and he had his own network of spies and informants, only a couple of whom were actually on Drolnar's payroll. It was a dangerous game, but one with rich rewards, and Drolnar had played it to perfection for almost 10 years. During that time, more than one pretender aspiring to political and economic power had appeared on the scene, but almost always proved to be nothing more than a puppet backed by a local guildhouse, or sometimes just a fresh-faced young merchant with delusions of grandeur, and both kinds were easily dealt with. The last such pretender had done fairly well for himself, actually, until he went too far by wanting to put Drolnar's network out of business. He was soon found in the south quarter in an alley behind a local inn, his throat horribly torn out and his mouth full of coins. Things had quieted down considerably since then. Still, Drolnar could never afford to be overconfident. His power was based entirely on who and what he knew and when he knew it. When he had gotten wind of a new power rising in the city, he had been inclined to dismiss it as a series of drunken hallucinations. Even he couldn't afford to track down every dead-end story. But the rumors persisted and other signs began to appear. The disappearance of usually reliable contacts, reduction of normal commerce, protracted silences from the city's other merchant leaders. And of course there was the political situation outside the city, the problem with the Arliks, and the threat of war. A general climate of unease had descended upon Clonillar, and that was bad for both business and political maneuvering. So Drolnar had taken it upon himself to track down the meaning behind the disturbances, and determine both what threat it posed and how he could turn that threat to his advantage. Weeks passed before he turned up any leads at all beyond the usual rumors and vague mutterings of a few tavern locals. He had begun to despair of discovering anything significant about the matter until it had, so to speak, sought him out. 5 days ago, on the evening Drolnar was supposed to have met one of his most reliable contacts in one of his counting houses, the merchant was startled out of his musings on the problem by a cry on the street outside, suddenly cut short. By the time Drolnar had reached the door, his two guards, both city guardsmen by profession, though in fact on his payroll, had arrived from their posts and were crouched over a body on the street, an arrow protruding from its back. As Drolnar ordered the two to circle the perimeter of the house looking for the assailant, he himself was always protected by more than just guardsmen, he noticed a small note attached to the arrow, which was in the fresh corpse of his unfortunate informant, and unfolded it. "Call off your dogs, merchant, or we'll bring them to heel ourselves," the note began. "If you want to know who we are and why we're here, be at the meeting in 5 days. If not, stay clear, or the next arrow lodges in your heart." Crude directions followed, along with a password for entry. Drolnar had not reacted visibly, but his mind raced with a mixture of admiration for the group's work and anger at the position in which he found himself, uncertain for the first time in an age as to what to do next. Certainly he couldn't ignore the threat. There were few in the city who could attack his operatives with impunity, and he was sure anonymity. He doubted his guards would find any sign of the attacker. The message had been sent by a professional, and professionals covered their tracks. The loss of the informant was inconvenient, to be sure. Creating reliable and loyal contacts was not an easy thing, but contacts were replaceable in time. And Drolnar had been threatened more times than he could remember by groups considerably more dangerous than an assassin in the shadows. He was not concerned about his own safety. What was most troubling was that he had somehow been connected to the search, highly unusual given the care with which he conducted his investigations. And that meant that for the first time, someone had as much or more information than he did. After hearing the reports of his unsuccessful guards and ordering them to dispose of the body quietly, Drolnar resolved to close the information gap quickly. And here he was, 5 days later, with little more information now than when he had started. Still, he had a name, Rix, and a face to put with it, and that was itself an advantage. Patience, he reminded himself, would reveal the rest. A whispered hiss suddenly emanated from the front door's keyhole, and the man who called himself Rix pushed himself away from the wall and silently set his mug on the table. Drawing his sword, he moved quietly over to the door, and after a short pause, cracked it open, peering through the narrow slit. "His coming's known to us," he whispered. A deep and rattling voice replied, "Our knowledge is our strength." Rix sheathed his sword and opened the door wide as it could go, in fact, for the creature that entered needed every inch to squeeze through. Drolnar's eyes widened as the huge being, at least 8 feet tall and as solid as an ox, made its way through the opening into the house. It was covered in a sopping wet black cloak like Drolnar's, the size of 3 of them, in fact, though as the creature removed the garment, the merchant thought he caught a glimpse of an odd symbol inscribed in the cloak's lining. But he barely had time to process the thought, as it was all he could do to keep his mouth from dropping open at what had worn the cloak. The creature was covered in short brown hair that bristled as he brushed the raindrops off, and his lower legs, impossibly rippled with muscles, ended in cloven shoes, iron-shod and with one wicked iron spike at each shoe's tip. The upper legs and torso were covered in a kind of sturdy, dark brown hide armor carved with a host of strange symbols and runes. The arms were bare and covered in the same coarse brown hair, muscles like iron knitted and relaxed as the creature cleaned itself of the rest of the moisture. But what most amazed Drolnar was the creature's head, massive, covered in hair, and with a protruding, bull-like snout. Saber-like teeth extended outside the mouth and onto the sides of the lower jaw, and two short but sharp horns emerged from the powerful skull, which ducked low to avoid hitting the ceiling. The eyes, yellow with black pupils, glared out from beneath two bristling eyebrows, and Drolnar had the uneasy sense of being examined both inside and out. He had never seen one of these creatures, but he had heard them described many times, sometimes with respect, often with fear, occasionally with admiration. But no description did justice to the truth. Drolnar was unquestionably staring at an Arlok. Rix closed the door and slid the bolt closed before turning back to the new arrival. "You're late, Sikarb," he muttered, "and you know the schedule's tight." The creature turned its baleful eyes back to the one-eyed man and stared at him for a moment. Had even Rix quailed slightly in the face of that gaze, Drolnar wondered, and then snorted, its nostrils flaring slightly. "I come at my own time, Rix," Sikarb replied in a deep bass voice that rattled as it exhaled, "and only the destroyer wills when that will be. I had to avoid the guards. The city must have doubled the watch in the past month, and not many work for us yet. And time is with us and against our enemies. None can stop the return." "Whether or not they can," Rix replied, "they can make things difficult for us to speed its coming. And my lads won't be patient for long. I can only beat sense into so many of them, and the rest are hungry for the pay they've been promised. Some of them are wondering when this will all happen." Again the Arlok paused before answering, breathing deeply. "None can stop the return," he repeated. Then, as if struck by a thought, he turned his head a little to the side and opened his eyes wider. "Unless you doubt it will occur?" he inquired, his voice rising slightly with the question as his muscled arms tightened nearly imperceptibly. Drolnar was no warrior, but no one read body language better than he, and a barely concealed threat clearly lay below the surface of the question. Rix did not miss the point and chuckled slightly, though in a somewhat forced way. "I have faith in the return and the reward promised, but my lads have seen nothing of either so far, and they're getting restless. We need to move soon." Sikarb moved his head upright again. "We will act as the destroyer wills. Our moment will come in due course." He paused and then turned his head back towards Drolnar, his eyes widening and nostrils flaring slightly as he observed the merchant. For his part, Drolnar hoped his evident shock at seeing the Arlok had subsided enough to prevent comment, because it was quite evident to him that despite Rix's claim, the one-eyed man was not in fact calling the shots in this affair, any more than Drolnar could have survived more than a few seconds in a fight with a beast who regarded him now with obvious contempt. Sikarb clearly did not particularly care about Rix one way or the other, and Drolnar hoped to use that information to his advantage when he could. "Who is this?" Sikarb said at last, a low growl in his throat. "Blesian Drolnar, merchant at your service," he replied, bowing low. "I was told I might be interested in your proceedings here tonight, and..."
"I was not informed of others being involved," Sikarb said, turning to Rix as the merchant, very unused to being both interrupted and ignored all within the space of a sentence, sputtered as he tried to regain his composure. "You were warned about the need for care." "This merchant," spat Rix, "has more or less run a good part of this city for nigh on 10 years, and he started asking around about us. Of course, we could have just killed him, but there was no need for unnecessary questions, and his influence could prove useful. He was told either to back all the way off or to get all the way in, and you can see for yourself what he chose."
"I see," said Sikarb, turning his massive head again back to Drolnar, who had regained his placid demeanor. "Then you know why we are here, and what we intend to do. And you know what steps must be taken to make it happen." Drolnar hesitated for a split second under the Arlok's withering gaze. It was dangerous to admit ignorance, but to lie, and be wrong, could have even more dangerous consequences. Rix, however, saved him from having to make the perilous choice by answering for him. "He knows almost nothing, Sikarb, nothing more than any fool could discover by keeping his eyes and ears open. All of Clunillar knows something's up, something serious, but not many know what to do about it except cower in their beds and hope someone else fixes things for them. As for this one, he..."
Now it was Drolnar's turn to cut the other off, which he did with gusto, ignoring the other's murderous glare as he spoke.
"I'm no ordinary citizen cowering in a bed, friend," said Drolnar, "and I know more than you think. I've been more closely connected to the city and its workings than the Duke himself for years now, and I know when things are," he chose his words carefully, "unusual. It's bad for business when they are, and I know nothing about it, and so it's my business to ensure I do know. Specifics and details, well," he chuckled, "that's what I'm here to discover. But the basics? I know those as clearly as I know the password to get in this room. You risk no lost confidences by speaking in front of me." These last two statements were absolute and utter lies, but despite what Drolnar did not know, he certainly knew a foreigner when he saw one, and it was evident to him that both of the other two he faced, especially Sigharb, had little knowledge of city politics or networks. This was a gamble, but a reasoned one, and Drolnar seldom played a hunch wrong. Rick spat loudly. "This cell thief is a liar, Sigharb, and knows little more about this than that informant of his we skewered last week. Sigharb raised one massive arm, silencing Rick's, and stared at the merchant for what seemed like an eternity. "Perhaps not," Sigharb finally said. "But we act as the destroyer wills, and it is not clear to me what role this merchant must play. Certainly he is lying about some things, but he is telling the truth about others, and if he learned enough about you that he became a threat, there may be others who followed a similar path." He moved closer to Drolnar, towering over him despite having to crouch below the low ceiling, and glared down at him, hot breath flowing from his nostrils. "If what you know of Clunilar is of use to us, you will be allowed to live upon the destroyer's return. Indeed, you may even become a part of it. If it is not," the beast continued in an almost gentle rumble, lowering his great head to just above the merchant, who was paralyzed by a mixture of fear and fascination with the Arlek's great yellow eyes, "you will die with all the others, your own heart's blood drowning your cries for mercy. None can stop the return, and none will." An hour later, a shaken Belezian Drolnar emerged from the small house and hurried down the street the way he had come, trying to avoid splashing in the puddles left from the now-ended rainstorm. But even his anxious glances, darting from side to side, could not catch the shadow of a creature that silently slipped out from behind a barrel to follow him. A shadow which, had he been looking at directly, he would have sworn had changed from that of a rat to that of a hooded man. The merchant and shadow both made their way down the deserted streets of the city. I think I'll stop there. Thank you. I stopped a little more time than I thought. So, do people have questions about anything regarding this, or publishing, or how it happened, or this kind of stuff? Lay them on me if you do.
Yeah, we'd like to hear how you got started and how it published.
Okay. So, yes to all the... I began writing this book a decade ago, actually, in some form. In 1996, I did a little work on this. I had just gotten done with my master's degree, and I was royally sick of academic writing, and I was just tired of it, and I wanted to do something that was off the beaten path. And I had always, as I said, grew up loving this kind of stuff. I loved this kind of fantasy, and so I thought I should try my hand at it. And so I started, and as was usually the case for me in those days, I am the best beginner and not finisher of works you could ever imagine. I have 50, Nobel Prize winning novels that will never see the light of day because I got bored of them. Just brilliant for a page. And that was kind of the way it was here. I wrote about a chapter and then I just got sick of it and I had other things I was doing. And so I gave it up. Fast forward then to 2002 when I graduated with my doctorate from Brandeis, where a couple people know something about and the audience knows something about that. And I graduated from there in 2002. And again, 6 years down the road, I had again grown tired of academic writing after having to do a lot more of it. But the difference now was that I had actually finished something. I had to finish my dissertation because I couldn't just start it and stop. That wasn't going to fly. It was okay with my mom when I was 10. Not going to be okay when I was, when I was 27, 28, and I was in school. So I had to finish it. And finishing it was an enormous turning point for me because it proved that I could, in fact, finish work. Long work, extensive work. And so I started work again on this. And obviously, 6 years in the interim, there was a lot of stuff that changed. I had become, I hope, a better writer. So I had to rework a lot of the stuff that I had originally done. And then I worked through it, and I finished it about 2 years later in 2004. There was a lot of other stuff going on in the interim. I got married in 2003. I moved down to New York, so there was a whole bunch of stuff going on. I got my first college teaching job. But I finished it in 2004, and I started to query agents and publishers. And the reaction I got from agents was this is really good, but fantasy of this kind is oversold. I heard the oversold frame over and over again. You know, it's all over the place, and it's saturated, and blah, 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 blah. So I ended up not giving up, but I ran out of people to query. And I had a couple of very near misses, people that I went back and forth with and that were really thinking about it, but they passed, again, because they just said, I just don't know where I'm going to be able to do with it because there's so much of this kind of fantasy. So in 2005, I went to a convention in Indianapolis at the behest of some friends called Gen Con, which I mentioned before we got started. It's the largest fantasy science fiction gaming convention in the world. About 15,000 people come to it every year. And there were a lot of big authors and editors there as well. And I went to one that was called Big on the Small Press. And the editor was a guy named John Helfers. And he basically acquired books and edited them for Five Stars Fantasy Line. And he talked a little bit about that process. And I liked what he had to say. And I still had this book sitting there. And so I went up to him and talked to him about it. And he said to me, when I told him this thing about oversold, he said, well, the problem with that argument is the reason it's oversold is because people are buying it, right? Like, I mean, that's why it's oversold. By definition, like, so he said, that's silly. And he's like, I think that this would be really good. And I think you should submit it to me. And so I submitted it to him a few months later in, I think it was now January of 2006 now, is where I actually submitted to him. He read it. He had some suggestions for revisions. I made some of them. I gave it back to him. We went back and forth several times. So he got the revised one in January 2007. He then went through it again, and we again went back and forth. And he finally made an offer to me in late 2007, which I then accepted in January of 2008. And the book itself just came out last month. So that's a sign about how ridiculously long this process is. I laugh when people talk about, so, you know, what is it like, this new book? Like, this new book? You know, I've had this book in my mind for, you know, a long time. And in the meantime, I've written a couple of other books since then because, it takes a while to get this stuff out there. But one of the things that was really helpful for me in this process was not sort of shutting off doors. There is a school of thought that says you try for a certain period of time and then you say, okay, the heck with it, and you move on to the next book. This may be a holdover from my high school laziness, but if I'm going to put this much work into writing something, I'm not just going to throw it in a book in a desk drawer. And I thought that the book was good enough, especially since the feedback I had got was not, this is a bad book, start again. It was, this is a good book, but I just don't know where to sell it because it's famous phrase of oversold. So I'm really glad in that sense that I actually stuck with it. And Five Star produces a very high quality product and is very well respected. There are a lot of authors who produced work with them. Frank Herbert, who wrote Dune, one of his books came out with them years and years ago. And since then, Jim Hines, other sort of known fantasy authors, David Neil Wilson, no relation, wrote books as well for Five Star and since then have moved on to larger mainstream presses. And sadly, this company is actually getting out of the fantasy business after this year. So I got it in just under the gun, actually. So what it means is that for the sequels and for the other books that I've written, now that's going to be, I'm going to have to go to a bigger publisher, which is what I was planning to do anyway, but now I have no safety net. So, but there's a good precedent for people to take, larger publishers, to take small published authors that have succeeded and to take them as a strong precedent. In fact, that's becoming more common every day. It is almost becoming the norm in some genres, so I'm hoping that will happen to me. So that's kind of as not so brief, but it's as brief as I can make it.
I have a feeling, having heard this twice, and it sounds better the second time, that you've not just read fantasy literature. I'm sure you've steeped yourself a lot. I have a great feeling, Greg, that you've read history, political sense, political systems, weaponry, urban layouts.
Yeah.
I gotta tell you, this stuff, besides my folklore, folktale stuff that I devour like crazy, this is a world I can chop my teeth. I can believe in this world 115%.
That's great. I'm glad, because that's obviously what I try to do.
And you know what? And this is a world that I want to know more about. I want to know its myths. I want to know its folktales. I want to know its music.
That's good.
I want to know what the Arleks tell each other in their story swaps.
Well, and it's funny. There's a lot. There are a lot more Arleks actually in this book. I've had a very positive reaction. The race that people are most struck by are the Arleks, and it's the Arleks, and it's amazing to me. I've heard people. I had one of the guys who gave me a very nice review for this book said, "You should just write." He wrote to me separately, and he said, "I just wanted to let you know I've posted this review. And by the way, you should write spin-off books about the Arleks." And usually, I said, I think I might want to actually get the trilogy sold somewhere before I start writing spin-offs.
I want to know about their history.
But yeah, well,
I want to know about this destroyer. This destroyer sounds to me like something out of the Arabian Nights, and the destroyer of destinies comes at some.
That's right. That's right. And I can't even. He may not even be an Arlek, Robert. It's possible. That he's not. But I guess the point is that I think getting published is a significant step forward when you're doing it with a reputable place. Now, there are a lot of places that are not reputable. This is a reputable place and well-respected. And I thought that was important for me to actually go that route rather than just say, the heck with it, and put it in a desk drawer. And the key thing to move forward is to continue to try to produce more work. And so as excited as I am about this book, and as much as I want to read, I've already done a few readings of this and some radio appearances, and I'm going to be doing quite a few more, I also have to be cognizant of sort of, future work and kind of going on to the next stuff down the line. That's how you build a career, not just writing books.
What's the future of the series? Let me go back on this. Did you say before that this book does or does not have maps?
It does. I mentioned that. Yeah, that's right. You had asked that question. It does have a map. There are a couple of maps that are related to it. I had a friend who actually designed the map for this, for the front of this book, which I was very happy about.
And how much of the world is put on this map?
The entire world, but not. I haven't done city details or things like that, but I have done the full land, so you get a sense of where all the places in the book are.
We know what's on the borders.
Yes.
Clune.
Yes. You know what are on the borders of Clune. You know what all the different cities are called. There are four big cities. Clune Ilar, Clune Aerith, Clune Anor, and then Clune Corin in the south. And all four of those cities are sort of listed on here as well. One of the things, though, I think I mentioned to you when you asked that question a couple of weeks ago on Jim's radio show, I'm always cognizant of there has to be a balance struck. A lot of fantasy authors, especially if fantasy authors write really, 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 really long, large books.
Sword of Shannon,
700, 800, 1,000 pages. And then they write them into trilogies, and they write them into quintuple, and Robert Jordan, poor man, passed away before he could even finish his series because he was writing prequels before he finished it.
The 38th book of the trilogy.
It's crazy. And Brandon Sanderson, who's the guy who's finishing that trilogy, finishing that series, had to write it, he announced, in a duology. Like, he can't even finish the final book in a one-part. He's got to do a two-part book. So it's crazy. And I love reading books, obviously, and I love reading fantasy work, but there comes a point where you have to balance the quality of the storytelling against the world building. So I could write a source book, and it would be 1,500 pages, but, there's a story, and people want to hear the story, and that's the best thing that I try to do is balance between the storytelling and the world building, ultimately. So I'm hoping that that's maybe one of the things that's different is that, it's got some heft. You could do some damage to someone with this, but it's not necessarily well suited for a doorstopper. You know what I mean? It's balanced.
But it would be. But I think, legitimately speaking, if you're successful with the series, you could do some spin-off stories.
Sure. Oh, and I know. And I mean, believe me. Just besides this part, which is a planned trilogy.
A great universe to play with.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. There are other ideas that I have within that universe that I'd like to do, although I have two other series that I'm also sort of working on that are very different kinds of fantasy. But the idea is that I can jump from series to series as situations warrant, and if I'm ultimately considered to be good enough as a writer, then that will allow me to do that. And I have actually an anthology that I'm going to be co-editing. An anthology, I'm going to be at Worldcon in a few weeks in Montreal, and there are going to be publishers we're speaking to, which is an anthology of short stories related to speculative fiction and politics. And the author list is great. It's a really, really good author list. And so this is an example of something I would never have had the opportunity to do had I not gotten this published, had it not gone this way. And so the more momentum you build up, the more interest you find. Some of those publishers I'm going to be talking to also publish novels, not coincidentally. So I'll be speaking to them about my work too. So the hope is that all of those, you keep all those balls in the air, and eventually, one of them hopefully will really.
What's your other fantasy book?
So I have two series besides this. One is called Icarus, which is finished. It is a book about a young, fair-skinned boy with wings who falls into the heart of a dormant volcano and meets the creatures that are there. And it's told from the perspective of him and from the perspective of a 3-foot-tall, red-skinned prospector called Jelinek, who lives in the volcano. And the two of them sort of alternate telling the story. A very, very different kind. In fact, I wrote that book partly because of my annoyance that it's oversold. I'm like, well, this is going to be oversold. You know? So I wrote that, and that has gotten some positive attention, and that is currently on being shopped to agents and publishers. And then I have a third book, which I'm working on now, called Gray Shade, which is about a religious assassin. And it is set back in the... it's not historical. It is also set in a fantasy world, but a much darker world. And much grittier and much more, a guy who literally assassinates in the name of his God. Not as a radical, but because he's told that's what he needs to do to survive. So think of, the Bourne Identity meets...
The Old Man of the Mountain.
Or meets China Miéville, City in the City, say, something like that. Something in that combination. So that's what I'm working on as we speak. Yes?
How did you get it on radio shows, and what show did you hear it on, and how did you get it reviewed?
Okay. The radio show was called The Hour of the Wolf, and it's Jim Freund's show, which has been running since 1972. And it's on WBAI every Saturday morning, early, 5 in the morning. That's why it's Hour of the Wolf. Jim is a really remarkable man, as Robert knows. He has interviewed literally every speculative fiction authority, a person you could imagine, everyone. Isaac Asimov, Kurt Vonnegut, Margaret Atwood, Robert Heinlein, Ray Bradbury. I mean, just staggering. Did he?
Yes, he did a phone, phone interview.
Tolkien? Okay, well, I shouldn't be surprised. Jim is just staggering how much information he has on Harlan Ellison, sure. So he's done a bunch of different people. And I emailed him asking about doing a reading. He runs a reading called the New York Science Fiction Museum's Reading Series.
Yes.
And I emailed him and asked about that. And he said, well, he said, unfortunately, that's booked up until 2080 or something. He said, but I would love to have you on this radio program. And I had heard of Hour of the Wolf, but I hadn't looked at the guest list. And I thought, oh, my God. So I said, well, of course, I will do it. So I was on that on June 20th. Actually, 3 days after this was officially published, I appeared on that. It was a wonderful time. Jim's a very, very nice guy, in addition to being very knowledgeable. And people like Robert here heard me. It's why he's here. And other people called in the show.
The good thing about the show, number one, is he not only has well-known, respected authors that everybody would recognize, but he has new and...
That's right.
...that you wouldn't know. Now, I've never heard of Gregory Wilson until he had him on the show.
You're not alone.
but the great thing is sometimes... has the chance to take phone calls.
Right.
And so I want to know, for example, when I hear an author, hey, did you get this from Arabian Nights?
Right.
What's your folklore thing?
That's right.
So that's why you hear something like this, and I said, uh-huh. And then when it mentions Riverdale, I said, I gotta come to this.
Yeah, no, it's great. I'm glad. No, I mean, I was really pleased that I could be on that show, and now Jim is going to be bringing me back in October. With another, I should have mentioned before that I'm an associate professor of English at St. John's University. It's my day job. So I teach courses in fantasy fiction, and creative writing, and others, but those are two of my favorite ones. And so he's going to bring me back in October to talk about this book, the anthology, my other work, and to talk a little bit about the academic side of fantasy with a professor called Veronica Shanos, who's in New York, too.
Fairy tale specialist.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So she's going to be coming in October. So I'm looking forward to that. So that's how I did that. A lot of it is just contacting them directly. And you need to sort of quickly get over your worry about they will never contact you. You need to contact them and say, hey, I have... My publisher had, as all publishers should, review copies of this made. So they shipped out a bunch themselves. And they sent a box of ones to me. So I sent them out to various people, including one to Jim. And so that's how I got in touch with him. The reviews were similar. Some of the places are places that my publisher submits to anyway. The big four are Publishers Weekly, Library Journal, Kirkus, and Booklist. And a lot of times the big four will not review books at all. I got reviews from two of them. One was Publishers Weekly, and that was not a good review. I was kind of savaged by them. My editor was actually very upset. It was a pretty unprofessional review. Like, it was basically stop writing, don't ever write again. It was that kind of review. Yeah. And then Library Journal, 2 weeks later, came out with a review which was exactly the opposite. And it's owned by the same company, so it's very bizarre. The exact opposite. This is a great, you know, this is a great choice, and it's memorable characters, and it's in the tradition of this, and you should. So I have no idea. I assume the Publishers Weekly person was having a bad day, or they really don't like Arlex, or me, or something. I hurt them in a previous life or something. I have no idea. But anyway. And then the other review sources were bigger fantasy places. Science Fiction and FantasyWorld.com is a big site that I submitted to. I got a very good review from them. Dragons, Heroes, and Wizards is another big one, which I got a good review from them. And I have some other reviews outstanding as well that are still due to come in, probably about 5 or 6 more. So when all said and done, I'll end up with about, you know, probably about 9 or 10. And my hope is if I have, you know, if I go 9 and 1, you know, 1 lousy one and 9 good ones, then, you know, I'm
pretty
good
shape.
You should
know, by the way, one of the places that your book will be reviewed in the coming months is a website called Storytel Listserv.
That's right.
And here I have to say something. One of the reasons why I find this literature fascinating is because, like a lot of storytellers, and I'm part of the storytelling community, talking about professional storytellers,
yep,
which I am one, we storytellers cross borders, and we love stuff like this. In fact, when I get together with other storytellers, we talk more about original fiction, and I can guarantee you that at a couple of upcoming festivals, your name is going to be bandied about all over the place.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Robert. Yeah, Robert actually was kind enough to, because he writes for this, I actually, the publisher sent him a copy to review, so I very much appreciate that. So that's how it happens, and as you get to know people, because the community is not that large, actually, all of a sudden, you know, these people know people, and all of a sudden you're hanging out with all these big-time authors, and, you know, there's no badge of entry. It's just that you happen to be spending time in the same kinds of places with them, and they get to know your work, you get to know their work, people start writing blurbs for each other, and, you know, that's kind of how it works. So it's, a lot of it is being able to approach people and not being worried, I guess, about what they're going to say, and being professional in how you do it. I mean, I had some credentials because I was a college professor, so I wasn't some punk kid. That helped a little bit in my responding to them. But it was also just, you know, I kind of tried to drop as many names as I knew, which in the beginning was not very many. So, you know, this blurb was written by David Neil Wilson, Bram Stoker Award-winning, blah, 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 blah. You know, and then now I can say this has been, you know, Jim Freund, who's the guy who does this radio show, and, you know, David Anthony Durham has spoken favorably of it. And then all of a sudden these other authors that people know, you can start dropping more names. Now that I have this anthology, I can say, oh, I've worked with, you know, 20 Hugo and Nebula Award-winning authors, which is now true, because I actually, there's this anthology that I'm working on.
When is that one coming out, by the way?
That we have no idea. The author's list is done, and the proposal is finished, and we're meeting with 5 publishers at Worldcon: Del Rey, Ace, Prime, Angry Robot, which is a division of HarperCollins, and Bane, and one other, which escapes me, Orbit. So I guess it's maybe 6, actually, that we're going to be meeting with at Worldcon to talk about.
So these are going to be fantasy stories with a political bent?
Correct. That's one of the parts, one volume, that they even have a title. Volume 1 is called The Phaser, The Pen is Mightier Than the Phaser. Volume 2 is called The Pen is Mightier Than the Broadsword. We got so many good authors. Yes, we had so many good authors that we decided to split it and make one science fiction and one fantasy. So Joe Haldeman, Robert Silverberg, Barry Malzberg, Mary Robinette Cole. Just a ton. Well, Mary Robinette Cole is one that I'm going to use for that. Tony Pye, David Anthony Durham, Minister Faust. Let's see. Elizabeth Bayer is likely, although not sure yet. And there's a bunch of others who I've forgotten now. And it's a good mix. There's a mix all the way along. There's a mix of up-and-coming authors and established authors. There are a lot of Hugo and Nebula Award-winning authors, especially on the science fiction side. James Patrick Kelly, John Kessel will be writing for it, too. Dennis Danvers is another one of the fantasy ones. There is a nice mix of gender, race, ability, you know, in terms of, like, established quality in the community. And the commonality is that they are all wonderful writers. And I've actually read a couple of stories. Patrick O'Leary submitted one to me already, which is just great. And so I'm very excited about it. I pitched this. And again, the editor who's working with me is the guy who bought this book initially and now is able to take it to these other big publishers. And he said, oh, you know, I think we can make this into duology. And so I'm very excited about that. And I'm always mindful of the fact that I'm a writer who edits, not an editor who writes. So editing is never going to be my primary job. But I'm very excited about working with those people and with my work going forward. So.
Is that a question?
Sure.
This other book that you said that you did, it's like a male but he has wings.
Correct.
Do you think that would work for the young adult market?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I never thought of it as a young adult book per se.
It would work.
Right, there's nothing that would preclude it from being that, though. I mean, you know, there are certainly battles and things like that, but there's nothing that's particularly violent. And besides, YA is, you know, at this point, has gotten to the point where there aren't too many barriers anyway in terms of what you can write about in YA. So yeah, I mean, it's certainly a possibility. And when I've queried people, I've told them this could be used for, you know, either one of those markets. And since I have a lot of respect for what a lot of people are doing in young adult work, that's fine. So I don't have a particular restriction on it either way. So yeah, I appreciate the suggestion. And yes, that's something I did think about.
I mean, I'm definitely, like, if you look at the New York Times bestseller list, because I've been following it, just that's what it's all about. I can definitely see it going on to that.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, I'm cognizant of how popular, especially with Harry Potter and everything else, this stuff is.
Do you see even a writer like James Riordan with the Percy Jackson series?
Yep, sure.
Wonderful series.
Oh, sure.
Amazing.
In fact, I think there are some adult authors who have tried to run back to claim young adult, and in some cases, I think they're doing it for commercial reasons, you know, more than actual artistic reasons.
For example.
You know? Yeah, oh, yeah.
Her Changeling.
Yeah, so I'm going to laugh when I see people like Sherilyn Kenyon and see how she desperately did. Wait, no, I am young adult. No, you're not. Your vampires are, you know, rather too sophisticated, I think, for that. But yes, but I'm very much would like to pursue that, too, and I've made people aware as I'm submitting this. And we'll see where it goes. It's a quirky book, but I like it a lot. And part of the reason I like writing that different from this is that they're all such different work.
What I'm looking forward to is your religious assassin novel.
Well, the name of that book is called Gray Shade, and I'm about a third of the way through it. And if I can ever kick myself a little bit more, you know, and if my daughter will allow it, that you all met earlier, I will get it done by the end of the year. So, I think I'm coming to the end of the hour, so I'll just say two things. First is to thank all of you again for coming. Second is to thank the library for hosting me. This is our local branch, and I'm really pleased to be there. And then the last thing is to say again, I can't sell books here, but again, if you, you know, are of such a mind, I may have books available elsewhere. So thank you very much.